You do bounce back quicker. That's what 2%ers do. It rains on 2%ers. Their train gets cancelled. Their football team loses as well. But
so the recognition from an organisational perspective is that our leaders are not stepping up.
I'm very open, and I think most times encourages people to be open with me. So that helps. And then I work with them. And usually people will let you know where they are. You know, if you ask the right questions, if you're curious, if you listen, if you let them speak and you really listen to what they're saying, I think then you can work out, okay, I think this person needs this direction and this is how I can help. But I am always careful not to push, I hope.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy LaPata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello, and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy LaPata. Thank you very much for joining me. I am very excited to welcome my guest this week. She's someone who I met at an event late last year. We've had a number of conversations since, and she's really impressed me and shared a lot of her journey with me. And it's something that I think would bring a lot of value to you as a listener to the podcast. So I asked her if she would kindly come and share here as well. So one of my wide-ranging conversations rather than laser-focused themed ones, but the reasons why will become apparent. She's a chief of staff and director of organizational change at Guy's and St. Thomas's NHS Trust, which, for the benefit of those outside the UK, that's the largest national health service organization in the country. She's worked in healthcare for 20 years in various corporate and operational roles. And within the last 10 years, she's spent a lot of time leading large-scale change within and across functional and organizational boundaries. So there's a lot of experience, both in terms of her personal career journey, the support she's had and the change she's had to lead, as well as the challenges that come with being on the leadership team of such a large and heavily spotlighted organization as Guy's and St. Thomas's. So welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, Tendai Wellman. I'm so glad you've been able to join us.
Thank you, Andy, and lovely to be here and good to see you again.
Good to see you too. So let's get straight into it. I've mentioned the career that you've had, and you've reached a very senior level in, as I said, what is a high profile NHS trust. But from our previous conversations, I know that that wasn't necessarily the path you plotted for yourself, and you weren't always that career focused. So I think it would be great if you could share a little bit of your background and the change that led you to take that path.
Thank you, Andy. So I guess I kind of stumbled into the NHS. So I moved to the UK from Zimbabwe. Well, I was born in Zimbabwe and then went to university in South Africa and then moved to the UK in 2001. And at that point, my sister worked in the NHS. She was a nurse in the NHS. And my boyfriend at the time, who is now my ex-husband, he was also a worker in the NHS. He was a mental health nurse. And so I sort of stumbled into the NHS. And I think because it is so broad and varied, I found that I've stayed there. And I've been there for almost, well, I've been there for 20 years now. So considerable time and different roles, as you mentioned in the intro. And I think, again, getting to this point wasn't the plan. I think I thought I'd work in the NHS a couple of years and then probably find something else to do. My undergraduate degree was in sort of management and information systems, so not healthcare related at all, really. And at that time, I thought I would be going to New York, be in London for a bit, and then go to New York where my other sister was. So I was on a path. But I think the NHS has led to so many different opportunities. And I think I've found, in terms of bringing together what's important to me and where I feel I can add value and it makes sense, I think that's how I've ended up where I am.
And what would you say the role was of other people in that journey? You know, how did other people help you identify changes of direction, identify where you were most naturally a fit and support you along that way?
So I think sometimes it does take other people. And I don't think I realized what my skills were or where my strengths lay. And so it was with other people, you know, putting opportunities in front of me, suggesting I could do different things. I think because I'm not clinical by background, actually, there are a lot of non-clinical roles and opportunities to either work in sort of operational day-to-day delivery or supporting change or the other various aspects to the NHS. So I think that guidance, that almost, you know, what you could do, where your skills could really add value, I think that helped. Seeing some different roles as well, seeing, okay, I think this is what I like. I think I could do this. So it was all of those different opportunities. And then I guess for me, just being curious and open helped as well. So it did, a lot of things came together, but not necessarily in a planned way.
And would you say that you have always been a confident person who knows what she wants and where she's going to go and will take the bit between her teeth and really go for it? Or have there been times when other people have had to push you on and spur you on and really help you believe that, that what they see in you is what you can actually achieve?
Yeah. Good question. I think I was a confident child. I was a very bright child, and I was told that I could have anything, you know, and be anything. So that was a lot of confidence instilled in me. And I think things just felt that way at the time. And then I think as I got older, sort of my teens, and from my perspective, didn't live up to that potential, I think that did have a knock. So school and university, whilst I have the qualifications that I have, the degrees I have, I think personally, I don't think I fulfilled my potentials in that sense. I think that affected my confidence. And then over time, I've gained that back again by people saying, actually, you do bring a lot, because I think it's always against your own measure of yourself that you judge yourself. And I think I do judge myself quite harshly. And it was other people saying, actually, you know what, you have some real strengths there. And then just seeing the impact around me, people I worked with or team members and people I developed over time, I think I did start to believe in myself as well.
Do you think that the upbringing you had, that you had that instilled in you to believe in yourself, meant that when people started to believe in you, it was easy for you to follow them and agree with them, so to speak?
Yes. Yes, I think I found myself again. I think I had the bit of life in between. When you're trying to work things out in your early, you know, 20s, starting a family, relationships, marriage, career, all of that can be a bit unsettling. And then I suppose, you know, over time, you start to see things more clearly. And then again, reminding myself of who I was and what I do bring. So I feel like I am the old Tendai in some ways. I've rediscovered and I'm, you know, up for whatever else life brings at this point.
So as a senior leader now, when you see people that you perceive have high potential within your own organization and you want to encourage them, how do you address it if they don't necessarily have that same belief in themselves, or in that they're in that slump in that self-belief that you had as part of your journey? How do you encourage them to see the potential that they have?
I go after them. I make it a point to let them know how I view them. So there's a saying that I always go back to, and it's sort of the way you see people is the way you treat them, and the way you treat them is what they become. So I think just letting someone know that actually they have that potential, or that you relate to them, or their journey is similar to yours, I think helps people to believe in themselves. And then I work with them if they're up for that. And if there are opportunities, I put them forward. So I think it's always important that people are growing and being nurtured and feeling like they have something valuable to contribute. And actually, the more they believe that, the more that's self-fulfilling anyway. So, you know, and I think it's taken me a while. And sometimes I try and, you know, I'm trying to shortcut journeys for people. I do this with my kids as well, where I'm like, actually, you don't have to go those three steps. Actually, if you did this, it works out. But obviously people need to get there for themselves a lot, I find.
So are you a believer that you can show people where they could get to, you can show them ways they could go, but ultimately you give them the space to make their own decision?
Yeah, yeah. I think you have to give them that space. I think not everyone will people won't follow the same course that you followed, not in the same way. So, but I think you can just by saying, look, I've done it this way and this has worked for me and there's no reason why this couldn't or wouldn't work for you. But people are different. Your starting point is different. And some people actually, and with managing people over time, some people are very happy in their roles and that's okay. And then you've got some people who always want the next opportunity or strive for something different or, you know, something more senior or perceived to be better. So I think you let people work it out for themselves, but guide them.
I think that's a really important point. I remember one of my first managerial roles when I was in my early 20s. I was managing someone who, to me at the time, he probably felt like he was in his 60s, but he was probably younger than I am now, to be honest. But he was a very quiet, probably introverted family man. Very traditional background, I think, as well. I think Muslim, either Muslim or Hindu, had that very deferential Indian approach, which I always found quite uncomfortable as someone in his early 20s and someone much older than me was always very deferential. And I always felt that held him back and he could achieve more if he was more assertive. And I was too almost aggressive in trying to encourage him to come out of his shell. And overly assertive. And he was quite happy with doing what he was. And it's only, I think, the benefit of age and experience has helped me see that I was putting my own personal ambition onto his shoulders. We need to recognize not to do that, don't we?
Yeah.
How do you get into that? How do you recognize where someone is comfortable and where you can push them and where you do need to just step back and let them find it for themselves or settle where they are?
So I think the one thing that has always come easy to me is people and understanding people and reading people. So I think you get a sense of who the person is. And I'm very open. And I think most times encourages people to be open with me. So that helps. And then I work with them. And usually people will let you know where they are. You know, if you ask the right questions, if you're curious, if you listen, if you let them speak and you really listen to what they're saying, I think then you can work out, okay, I think this person needs this direction and this is how I can help. But I am always careful not to push, I hope. I encourage. It takes time. So I know that I'm not the finished product and people's journeys can start at different points and it almost doesn't matter. So when they're ready, sometimes it's you plant a seed and you just leave it. And then sometimes, you know, it's quite quick and then sometimes nothing.
When the student is ready, the master will appear, I think is quite something along those lines, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You get sometimes what you ask for. You open yourself up to things and then you find those opportunities come forward or present themselves.
So a lot of what we've been talking about in the last few minutes, we could classify under the term, the bracket of mentoring, whether formal or informal. And now you're a senior leader. I imagine, and we've had this conversation separately, I know that you're asked to mentor others a lot more. One of the things that Ruth Gotin and I talk about in our new book, The Financial Times Guide to Mentoring, is the minority tax. The minority tax being the added burden to someone who comes from an underrepresented background when it comes to being a role model and a mentor for those who want to succeed where they've succeeded. As a Black woman in a sector where there is underrepresentation of Black women at senior levels, how does that show up for you and how do you handle that?
Early on in my career, I didn't want to have to think about it. It's almost you're just trying to show up, you know, turn up and do a good job. You're not trying to think about all the different things that stop you from doing that. So I think I was quite oblivious and I just assumed if something didn't go well, it was because I hadn't done a good job. Like I did take on, and I think because of the person I am, I'm always trying to do better in that sense. And then I think as I've, you know, become more senior and other people like me have reached out, you realize that it is something that you need to face into and support people with. I mean, there's the whole, you know, you can't be what you can't see, and people can see me now. And I know they are encouraged by that. And then because they're encouraged by that, they want to know my story, or they reach out, can you help me? And, you know, there's that bit. And then there's also the what you represent to the rest of the organization. So now you have, you know, a really senior Black woman. And so, you know, you can wheel her out every so often for this. And, you know, in a number of different guises, different organizations, I would be one of the only or the few Black leaders. So, of course, you know, it's a good news story. And then I'm in a good job and I'm considered good at what I do. So then everyone is like, look how far we've come. But again, even that, it takes its toll sometimes, because you're either representing all, and I don't, you know, I am me. I can fully represent myself. I don't think I speak for everyone that looks like me, and even people that look like me. You know, there's a whole spectrum. It's a whole other conversation. But I know that it does help for people to understand and be able to relate. So yes, I guess I take it. It comes with the job. It comes with the territory, and it's important. So yeah, I deal with it.
And how much of a demand on your time is it? How do you create the space to be that role model, have those conversations, but still be effective in your job, where some of your white male colleagues, similar level, may not have that same pressure? I don't want to call it a burden, but that same pressure on their time.
So I try and bring those two bits together if I can. So if in doing my job, I can encourage other people to do the kind of work I do, then it's a bit easier. It's almost like I can have people shadowing me for in different meetings because they're trying to learn how to be a change manager, or program manager, or strategy lead. I think it does take time away, but I think we all choose how we spend our time. And if I think it's going to help the other person, and I look back on the help I've had over time, but then also that one conversation with that senior woman 6 years ago sparked something, and then that led me to where I am now. You know, it's those sorts of things that you realize are important. So it's 10 minutes, it's half an hour, it's an hour. We can find the time, because you know, at some point, it will lead to a change, a positive change. And even if it doesn't, you listened and you made someone feel heard and valued. So yes, I make the time. It does take time. And there are many, many examples of things that my white colleagues don't have to deal with. But again, I have to, so I can get through. I understand this is my lot. You know, my mother has five children. I'm the youngest of five children. And so she holds up her hands and she says, you know, all these fingers are different. They'll be different. There'll be one short, fat one, or just, we're all dealt with different hands. And you deal with what's in front of you. So I suppose I don't know any other way to be other than the Black woman I am now. So it's just my lot, I suppose. It is my pragmatic approach to this, because what's going to be different? I'm not going to wake up tomorrow and have to, and suddenly I'm a white man, you know. I'm not. So this is who I am. This is what I have to deal with. And actually I find value in that. I see the value, and it makes me feel like I'm able to have a positive impact on someone else. And that's great for me. So it's selfish as well. I feel great about myself if I'm able to help other people.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Because, you know, we talk about the time pressures and the commitment, and I wanted to avoid using the word burden, but in terms of the burden on your time, there's that element. But there's the reward as well, that the person that's not mentoring people and not seeing people achieve what they didn't think was possible, then they're not getting that reward. So there's that element as well. And I would just say that if you did wake up tomorrow and found out you were a white man, you'd have a hell of a shock. So we talked about you mentoring other people, but now you're in a very senior role. Do you still get mentored yourself?
Yeah, So I find it in different ways now. I think I look to others and I learn from all of them. So I think I see that opportunity. It's almost, I don't want it to just be one person either. So I'm actively going out of my way to seek those experiences and those people and those conversations that spark something. And sometimes that leads to an ongoing relationship. And sometimes it's just a couple of conversations. So I still seek that guidance. I don't have a formal mentor right now, but I have had in the past, and I've had coaching and I have an exec coach. So it's all still really, really valuable.
Enhance your mentoring skills with the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring by Andy Lapata and Dr. Ruth Gotian. Secure your copy early by pre-ordering today on Amazon or your preferred bookseller.
And from one of our previous conversations, I recall you shared with me about someone you mentored that came to work on your team, and they effectively mentor you now, even though they're in a more junior role. So you have reverse mentors as well, as we would term it. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
You get put into situations at work where, you know, the whole concept of mentoring, reverse mentoring, where you're learning, you're actively learning from someone who's in a different position from you. So she was actually someone else's reverse mentor. She's Pakistani, and her mentor was white. She was mentoring a white woman, more experienced. And the work that they did together, I guess, led to her getting the position on my team, which is essentially, now she supports me, but her potential was spotted by someone in the organization. But this was through a relationship where she was learning, you know, my colleague was learning about this other colleague in terms of culture and all of the different things that made up, you know, who the person was. And at the same time, her potential was recognized and then she was put forward for opportunities. So it's carried on, and now she's part of my team. But again, I learn so much from her. So, you know, I'm a black woman, she's a Pakistani woman, and there's just so much that we have in common and so much learning that goes both ways. And I think that is what it is with mentoring. I think both sides should benefit from that, and people should see it as an opportunity just to learn about another aspect, another perspective.
What comes through is that you're very open to learning from everyone around you. And I think that's a really important takeaway for people listening to this, that it's not just one directional. I want to shift topic a little bit now, and I want to look at your role and the functionality of your role. One of the things I said in the introduction was that I think we can learn a lot from you in terms of how relationships play a role in when you're working in the spotlight, when you're in such a high profile organization, such a bureaucratic potentially organization as well. So can you just talk a little bit about how important relationships are in your role and how you handle them? And particularly, you're going to be juggling a lot of different and conflicting demands, you know, internal stakeholders such as consultants, doctors, pharmacists, nurses, external stakeholders, politicians, patient groups, the media and so forth. Do you need the wisdom of Solomon? and how important are relationships in handling all those pressures?
So relationships are the most important thing I had to nurture in my roles. So, okay, I'm Chief of Staff and Director of Organizational Change. What does that mean? So I think in terms of me describing what I do, I support the organization to deliver on its objectives, on its strategy and on its objectives. And that can take different forms. You know, I am in the middle of most things in that I have to seek the different perspectives. I have to be seen as someone who is neutral or who's open to challenge, who listens, who brings people together, who plays things back in an open and transparent way. So people have to trust me is where I'm going with that, so that they can work with me. So I often have to lead on pieces of work that need that neutrality or that need that objectivity. So, and with everyone I work with, I'm very clear and they're very clear who I am. And it's always nice when you hear it back. So a colleague was describing me to myself and said, you know, you're straight down the line. You're really clear where I'm really clear where you stand. You don't have skin in the game and you're genuinely trying to reach the best outcome. So for people to feel that way, it's helpful because then there is that trust. And then from that trust, the relationship builds. And then once there is that relationship, actually some difficult conversations are just easier to have. It is very, very political. It's multifaceted. There's just, we're facing into multiple directions. So you do need to be able to do that in a way that helps us all to move on. And, you know, it's not easy. It's tricky stuff, but holding people true to, I guess, what we're trying to do together. So most people will align on that point. You know, we need to provide the best possible care for our patients. We need to reduce the numbers of patients waiting, you know, on the waiting list. We need to be more efficient in delivery so that we can create additional capacity. We need to shepherd our resources better so we're able to invest in the things that will support delivery. So all of those different interactions, all of those different ways, I think you find that alignment and then you try and bring the bits together. And actually, our challenge is there just isn't enough. So the context is always fraught in that sense. And then relationships become even more important just because almost the more challenging things get, the more you need to go back to just working well with people.
There's so much gold that you've just shared in that one answer that it's almost impossible for in the moment without going back through it to pull all the different threads. But I just want to play back a couple of the things and maybe we can explore a couple of them a little bit more deeply. One of the key things I just want to play back is that you earn that trust when people feel that you're listening to them and you have their interests at heart. So when I talk about vulnerable leadership, one of the things I talk about is leading from among rather than from above, moving away from the traditional autocratic view of the leader on a pedestal above everyone else. And actually, what you're almost talking about here is reflected in that, is you become a curator of ideas. Does that sound like a fair representation? How much of your own ideas do you take in from at the beginning? Or are you coming in saying, this is what we need to achieve? I'm going to start with a blank sheet. Where are you at? And then we'll curate it and arbitrate from there.
So I'm not short of opinion, but I try and not let that lead the conversation. So I will have, I guess what I will do is incorporate my view in the range of options. So if we're trying to come up with a way of doing something, I will have a fair idea just based on my experience, based on what I've seen, based on, you know, reading, you know, I'll kind of know what the answer is because that's kind of my job. But I have to work with people and I have to bring people along. And I also have to accept that I may not know. So I'm really open to, you know, I know what I know, but I have no idea what I don't know. Like literally, there's blind spots. So I actively will seek that out and I will, you know, what about this as a counter narrative? How about this? And again, because I'm speaking, sometimes I'm speaking to different people just to come up with that list of options. I will represent the other view just so we can have some, okay, if we considered this, you know, what would be the implications? You know, and work that through. So I like to be quite logical in my approach. But I think that process of, yes, I will inject what I think, but I won't ram it down your throat. And I will genuinely be open to, okay, what are the different ways? Because, you know, even if it's my knowledge or my options are based on sort of experience, everything is contextual. So actually what worked well in one organization may not translate. I think as with everything, there can be a high-level blueprint or a framework, but let's be clear that actually we have to make sure that it works appropriately in the right context.
So you say that you come in knowing what the answer is, but you're open to the different perspectives and different views. How common would you say it is that you would substantially change direction based on the conversations that you have?
So I think I know what the answer is. I have an idea of what could work, but I know that that could just be based on my previous experience or whatever it is I understand the answer to be. So I think my best work is not my best work. My best work is when I'm working with other people and genuinely when whatever we come up with, everyone is happy. In that sense, I'm a people pleaser. I like everyone to feel like, you know, we've come to an end point that, you know, everyone is happy with. I think the challenge with my job and many other senior ones is you won't make everyone happy, but at least be really clear on the rationale. And if you've discounted someone else's view, I think give them a reason, have some respect in that sense. So it's always about balance. I'm never black and white. There's the answer somewhere in the middle.
And how do you handle the fallout if someone really, it's something they passionately feel about, but you're not going the way that they believe is the right way? And they, as much as you try to explain it, they go away harboring some kind of resentment, because that's human nature. How do you handle that?
So I have now accepted that despite wanting to be a people pleaser, that's sort of my default. I want everyone to like me and I want everyone to be happy. I accept that won't always be the case. And, you know, if my handling it is, can I stand by my decision? And do I think it's the right decision based on the information that I have to hand and based on, you know, consideration of others' views? And if I can hold true to that, then I can only do what I can do. And if someone doesn't like me, I accept now. I don't think I'm the most popular person in the organization, but I'd like to think people respect what I stand for.
And sometimes respect is more important than like, for the reasons that you said. Yeah, absolutely. The other thread I wanted to pull out was, it was interesting to say, making sure that we have a common agenda. How difficult does that get in an organization like the NHS, where people have perhaps differing opinions on what the agenda should be?
I think if you take it right back, the agendas are shared. You know, this is ultimately, like, I'd like to think most people that work in the NHS know why they do. I think we're not set up to collaborate in the way that we should. We're not incentivized to collaborate and partner. And so, but we are moving to doing that a lot more. There's changes in legislation, changes in the approach where we will be held to account as partners for delivery. And in doing so, we don't always get to the same, you know, it's the how that's different generally. The why and some of the what will be the same, the how is different. And then you try and bring those bits together. I mean, it's with great difficulty. I have the job I have because it's so hard. So you almost need to find ways or people that can support with change and can deliver change and transformation with using all of the skills that requires, because it's a tough gig.
Yeah, it sounds it. And it's, I imagine it's been even tougher over recent months with lots of strikes across the NHS, junior doctor strikes, consultant strikes and so forth. How have those impacted your internal relationships with the people affected and your ability to do your job effectively as well?
I mean, it's live, isn't it? We're living this. We're living through the impact of the endless strikes. I think what I would say, as an organization, we support workers' right to strike. Like, we can't argue with that. The impact of the strike means we have to cancel. You know, if you are on the waiting list and you've been waiting, we might have to say, Andy, sorry, but we can't see you now for another 3 months, sometimes another 6 months. Sometimes we're not sure when we can see you. So I think it does then slightly pit different staff against each other, and that's not helpful. So we are clear that the fight isn't internal, right? There's a cost of living crisis. People need to look after their families. So that's a real challenge. That's why we get why it's happening. The impact is direct. And so we don't have the answer to that. All we can do is help staff understand what's happening, and we're transparent. We try and tell our patients this, you know, that, you know, we're sorry, but, you know, we can only see the very, very urgent patients. And, you know, your condition that wasn't that urgent when you were put on the waiting list, by the time we've cancelled you 3 or 4 times, it's probably getting pretty urgent, right? But we might not have clocked that because we haven't seen you. So that's the challenge of the strikes. And it's a tough one. And we are yet to hear from the government about what the response will be, but we can only do what we can do. And we therefore try and do this as compassionately as we can. We communicate with patients. We let them know that, you know, we haven't forgotten about them, but we are facing some real challenges in this space.
There must be times, and answer this as you feel comfortable, because I recognize that actually the question itself probably falls into the category of what I'm asking. There must be times where your personal thoughts and your personal feelings might be at odds with what you need to say, to given your role and the responsibility of your role and how that would be taken. I remember many, many years ago, I managed car parks and I said something to a journalist in Cambridge, quite innocently, that became front page news in the Cambridge newspaper and nearly cost me my job. And that was such a minor level of public focus compared to your role. How do you manage that balance of feeling strongly about something personally, but having to say something that might be slightly at odds about that in your professional role?
I think I have to maintain that professionalism. I know what my role is and how it's positioned. So I do need to be thoughtful. I like that word. I need to be thoughtful about what I say. I think there are many personally held views of NHS people. I think there's so many. I think it's fundamentally unsustainable, and all the solutions that we're throwing at it aren't going to fix the problem. So personally, I mean, the model of care would need to change quite significantly so that we can do this properly. How that looks, and I appreciate what the NHS is and what it represents to people, which is why nobody will touch this politically, because, yeah, it's so much easier to hold the NHS up as this, you know, amazing resource, amazing capability that the organization has. But it's crumbling. You know, it's crumbling. It's not sustainable. And we're letting so many people down. And how do you deal with that? How do you make peace with that? And I suppose in answer to my own question, it's, you know, I do what I can every day to see, you know, that's all I can do, really.
Well, it sounds like an exceptionally challenging role. I don't envy you at all, but you're clearly doing some great work there. It's been really, I feel lucky and honoured that you've shared your journey and your thoughts with us on the podcast, and there's so much to take from that. You said that you like people to like you ideally and be happy with what you've done. Well, I like you today and I'm happy with what you've done here. So Tendai, thank you so much for joining me on the Connected Leadership podcast and sharing everything.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great conversation and time has just flown by. I can't believe we've been talking for this long.
Absolutely. And there's more we could talk about. Maybe for another time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So thank you so much to Tendai. There was so much there. I did promise quite a wide-ranging conversation. I mean, we could have a whole episode just purely on what's happening in the NHS at the moment and the relationships within and digging deep. I must admit, not being a political journalist and wanting to be respectful of Tendai and not being a sensationalist, I wanted to tread relatively carefully there and just focus on what we're trying to get. And I think some really pertinent insights there that will be very helpful and transferable to other roles. Because as I shared from my own experience, just because you're not in the spotlight, the public eye in a sensitive role doesn't mean you don't have these similar challenges at times. And a nice chunk on mentoring, which is, as the new book comes out this month, seems appropriate. But it was particularly appropriate for Tendai, given the discussions that she and I have had over the last few months as well. So I'm really grateful she's joined us. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please do rate it, share it, tell other people about it. Join the conversation on LinkedIn and other social media. And whatever you do, join us again next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great connected leadership tips.